Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lisa Alaferis, health editor for KQED News in San Francisco, and your moderator for tonight's program. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is also generously underwritten by the California Wellness Foundation. Today's discussion is 16 and Pregnant, the Reality and Politics of Adolescent Reproductive Care. These issues span education, politics, health, family life, and more. Tonight, we'll discuss topics ranging from birth control options to the federal decision to block over-the-counter sales of an after-sex contraceptive pill to girls under the age of 17, to teen access, to abortion, to teen parenting, and more. To address these issues, we turn to our panel of four, which brings together experts from the fields of healthcare, psychiatry, community organizations, and politics. First, Dr. Sophia Yen. She is a clinical assistant professor specializing in pediatrics and adolescent medicine at Lucile Packard Children's Hospital at the Stanford School of Medicine. She is also the co-founder of She Heroes, a nonprofit showing teens that they can overcome challenges and become tomorrow's heroes as long as they work hard and apply themselves. Welcome, Dr. Yen.
Thank you so much for having me here tonight.
Jane Malden is an associate professor of public policy at the UC Berkeley Goldman School of Public Policy. She has evaluated the teen-parent component of California's welfare reforms. Professor Malden, thank you for being here.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Next is Dr. Lynn Ponton. She is a professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, where she specializes in child and adolescent psychiatry. Dr. Ponton has published several books on adolescent sexuality and the behavior of teenagers. Dr. Ponton, welcome.
I'm looking forward to this. Thank you.
And Lupe Rodriguez. She is the director of public affairs for Planned Parenthood Marmonte. Planned Parenthood Marmonte operates in 33 counties in California and Nevada and is the largest Planned Parenthood affiliate in the country in both geography and clinics. She helps to advance reproductive care services provided throughout her region. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Yen, let's start with you. Can you give us a framework to understand the issue of teen pregnancy? What percentage of teenagers are having sex, and how frequently are teenage girls getting pregnant?
So what I tell people, a basic statistic, plus or minus 5%, is that about 25% of high school freshmen have had sex, and that is, what is that, 9 plus 5, 14-year-old, 13-year-olds have had sex. So 25%, one out of every four. This is nationwide and certainly different by demographic and inner city versus outer city. And then 10% convert each year from virgin to non-virgin. So then you go 25%, 35%, 45%, and by senior year, 55%. So when we talk about teenagers having sex, I think we are in denial if we talk about abstinence only until marriage. Marriage being, on average in the United States, at the age of 25. And so if your hormones are kicking in at age 12, that's a long time to hold out. And what my favorite book that I read a long time ago was Al Franken's book, where he challenged his Harvard group to ask Republican leadership, how many of you have abstained until marriage? Because this would be so inspiring for the young people of America to hear that story. And none of them responded. One of them said, good luck. So it is a huge problem. And when you compare the pregnancy rates, I don't think sex is the problem. The problem is the access to birth control, access to comprehensive sex ed, and then the pregnancy rates resulting from lack of comprehensive sex ed and lack of access to confidential reproductive health care. And so when you compare our rates to other countries that are industrialized and educated, our rates are 4 or 5 times higher in teenage pregnancy. And that's nothing to be proud of. And in fact, something that I'd like to decrease by inspiring young people to aim higher and providing comprehensive reproductive health care.
Thank you. Professor Malden, so we've heard now that we have higher teen pregnancy in this country than in other Western countries, but teen pregnancy has actually declined quite a bit, not just during the last few decades, but since the idealized time of American culture, the 1950s. And how much has the rate of teen pregnancy changed, and what are some of the factors driving that change?
Well, I think it's a surprise to many people to realize that teen childbearing was at the rate of about 10% of each In 15 to 19 year olds in a year would have a baby in about 1956. So from that rate of 10%, we're coming down now to somewhere around 3.5-4% have a baby each year in the 15 to 19 year old age range. So that's a decline of far more than one half. We're approaching to one third of what it was in the 50s. And the decline has been absolutely steady. So teen childbearing is less and less common. And teen pregnancy was, of course, similarly higher in the 50s. And it, too, has been coming down. Teen pregnancy now is somewhere in the realm of 6% of teens each year become pregnant. So what are the reasons for that steady decline? The overarching reason has to be the growing access of women to higher education and the changing labor market opportunities, the changing expectations about the role of women in society. That's just been a steady, ongoing change throughout the whole period. But, of course, there were very, very important scientific and policy developments in the 60s. We get the development of the pill. We get and other forms of contraception have come along since then. And we also get legal access. I mean, we forget that right through the early 60s, contraception was only available to people who were married. And so that changed. There was a Supreme Court decision, and then there have been other changes to expand access through publicly financed reproductive health, contraception, and so forth. Access to abortion was also important in the 1970s in reducing the rate of teen childbearing. Of course, it wouldn't change the pregnancy rate, but it certainly brought down the childbearing rate. Comprehensive sex education, where it is practiced and where it talks about actual contraception and sexual behavior, has been found to have some impacts, important impacts. And then in the last two decades, the HIV/AIDS epidemic has had a very considerable impact on the use of condoms. And many teens still don't use hormonal birth control, although you'd be surprised if you haven't been looking at the market for hormonal birth control in the last decade. It's changed a lot. There are a lot more options than there used to be. But actually, condoms and the use of condoms in response to the AIDS epidemic has been very important.
Thank you very much. Dr. Lynn Ponton, you've done a great deal of research on adolescent girls, and among other things, your research shows that there's a lot of misinformation among girls about their own bodies. Tell us about this misinformation and how that might be a factor in unplanned pregnancies.
Well, Lisa, I think that's really an important thing to think about, because Sophia Yen has already mentioned the lack of access, you know, to services and to birth control for girls. But there are other factors that really play a role in the rate of teen pregnancy that we see in America. And it's dramatically different from other countries that have different types of educational plans. And we can talk some more about that later. But in terms of girls in our country, they do pretty well on paper and pencil tests. Of course, sex is not a paper and pencil test when it comes down to it. It's a more complicated type of interaction. And psychologically, a lot of girls really do not explore, think about, or feel their own sexual desire. And there's some very nice work that's been done by Deborah Tolman, who worked at Wellesley and really worked in that very important area, a book called Dilemmas of Desire about American girls, which really says they're not aware in the psychological realm. They're really not ready for sex psychologically in terms of preparation. Then if we look at physical exploration of girls' bodies, girls lag behind boys in terms of masturbation and self-exploration. So in the biological area, girls are not prepared or ready either to make choices and decisions about pregnancy. And then if we take it a step further, our whole culture really affects the girls. And our social view of girls who are sexually active when they're seen as sluts and they're really treated in a very negative way and they experience a lot of prejudice and seeking out birth control makes them feel more this way. So you really combine these three factors, the social factors, the biological factors, and psychological, and our girls are really not ready to have sexual activity, and it's very difficult, I think, for them to access, you know, the birth control that they might really need and want. So those are some of the factors, I think, that play a really important role in America in our girls, you know, turning up with the rates of pregnancy that we've faced, really.
Thank you. And Lupe Rodriguez, we're hearing a lot of negativity around teen pregnancy, which I and you say that there's we talked today about the stigma around the way we talk about teen pregnancy, and you argue for talking about teen pregnancy in a non-stigmatizing way. Why?
That's exactly right. I think there wasn't a lot of sort of outright negativity or stigmatization in what was said before me. I think that, we at Planned Parenthood and in the reproductive justice movement, understand and recognize that there are a lot of social problems that come with, the aftermath of unintended teen pregnancies, that there are a lot of, bad consequences, that young women aren't necessarily always ready. And so all of that we recognize and we understand is a very difficult problem. However, when we start talking about teen pregnancy and teen childbearing in a negative manner, as Dr. Ponton mentioned, when we start talking about young women as sluts, when we start denigrating young people, we create an environment that is counterproductive, frankly, to curbing curbing teen pregnancy and teen childbearing. We create an environment, furthermore, for young people who have already experienced teen pregnancy that is hostile and that doesn't allow them to overcome the barriers that are already inherent in being a teen parent. It actually creates more barriers if we say, well, you know, your life is over, you've made a grave mistake, it's a disaster. It doesn't help young people who are already facing that overcome that and, you know, move on to be able to become productive and educated adults that, you know, that will do well in their society and for their families. So I think that that's one aspect of it. I think the negativity around talking about teen pregnancy and teen childbearing also affects policies that are put in place, because if we sort of narrow the focus always on, some of the languages like curbing the epidemic of teen pregnancy or, stopping it at all costs, we sort of lose focus about the fact that teen pregnancy and teen childbearing are caused by a lot of different factors that overlap and that affect, you know, young women in very many different ways. Socioeconomic status, the violence in their communities, the way that their educational opportunities and opportunities for jobs and just really having a full life that is necessary to be able to make the best choices and to delay pregnancy and to delay sexual intercourse. And so I think in that sense, it also takes away the focus from the holistic approach that's needed to prevent teen pregnancy. If we just focus on, the idea of preventing it at all costs and putting all the money into that particular thing. And then furthermore, I think, as was mentioned, it's disrespectful to assume that all teen pregnancies, and I think a lot of the language does that, it assumes that all teen pregnancies are unplanned and unwanted. I think that, again, if young people have the opportunities and the support to be able to make good choices for themselves and their families, they tend to, there's research from a community-based organization called California Latinas for Reproductive Justice that talks about how, supporting communities better at schools helps young women make choices that help them delay pregnancy and delay childbearing. And so I think all of that combined is part of why it's important to think about the negative side effects that might come about when we use negative language about teen pregnancy and teen childbearing.
Jane Malden, I see you writing a lot of things down there. Do you have something you'd like to add here to what Lupe Rodriguez is saying?
Well, not only to what Lupe was saying, but earlier, the question of the stigma and the view of teen sexuality and the contrasts that have been made to Europe. There was a very interesting research project done by a woman called Amy Shallett, who's at UC Berkeley. She's left. Gone on elsewhere now, but she studied teenagers having sex in Dutch families and contrasted them with teenagers having sex in American families and contrasted the attitudes of the parents in those families. And in Dutch families, teen sex was considered a very important, normal, valuable, personally, emotionally, psychologically valuable experience that should not be concealed, but rather should be undertaken with thought and care, and oftentimes with the support of parents, which most American parents would just find unthinkable. You may recall Hillary Rodham Clinton sort of saying, well, if she has sex, I don't want her to tell me about it. And that, I think, is the very, very common sense here. And the contrast that another country could actually do things in a radically different way was a really striking thing that came out of this research project. That from an American perspective, we are so myopic about this.
Dr. Shalit, whom she refers to, I think the book is called Not Under My Roof. And so the question they posed to the families in the Netherlands was, if your young person came home with their significant other and said, could they spend the night? The Netherlands was like, fine. And here in the United States, we would say, not under my roof, correct? Mm-hmm. Even in the most liberal, so she compared Berkeley to the parents over there. And the Berkeley parents were like, well, then I would be condoning it. And so the funny part in the United States is we're very puritanical, and we say, you know, sex is bad, sex is evil, save it for the one you love, right? And in there, they feel that sex is part of a normal relationship. I don't expect you to bring home somebody tonight and say, hey, this person's going to spend the night. But instead, I would expect to have this person spend the night a couple times, come to dinner, a long-term relationship, and then have sex. Whereas in the United States, we make it forbidden and can only happen when you're drunk or only on prom night or behind the bleachers. If not in your home, then where? Behind the bleachers, you know, in a car. And so I think that's a very huge contrast of the American values, and I hope that we can progress towards a more healthy attitude towards sex. And for me, I think, again, it's not necessarily about postponing sex. It's about when you have sex, be prepared. So I tell my patients, see me 2 months before you have sex, not after. And most young people actually show up 2 years after they have sex to their physician. And I go, can I help you prevent pregnancy and STDs 2 years after you had your first sexual intercourse?
So I appreciate this comparison to the Netherlands. However, we do live in the United States, and we do live in California. And so what there was mention made of many more options for birth control now, and that's changed dramatically. Dr. Yen, what do you see in your practice as far as how many more options are there? I want to talk about teen access to birth control, because I think that many families are in the middle. They're not closing their eyes to it. They recognize that it's happening. Parents talk to their children about birth control. So, but what kinds of options are out there, and what are the gaps that still exist?
So I like to think of birth control, certainly I am a proponent of born-again abstinence. The statistic is in any heterosexual encounter, only 30% of the women have an orgasm. So I tell my young people, if you're not getting off, why are you risking STDs and pregnancy? So you need to improve your communication. And so if just because you had sex doesn't mean you have to continue to have sex. And there's lots of other things you can do outside of sex. So that's the first contraception is abstinence, of course. And then the second would be a barrier method, which would be condoms. And then you go to your hormonal method. So there's the pill, the patch, the ring. And I think of them
The pill?
The pill, the patch, the ring. So the pill is every day, the patch is once a week, and the ring is a vaginal ring that a woman inserts and just leaves in there and thinks about once a month and changes it once a month. So the fewer times you have to think about it, the better the efficacy, right? If you have to take something every single day, the likelihood of you missing it, 1 out of 30, is a lot higher than if you have to think about something just once a month. Then there's Depo Provera, which you guys might have heard about, which is called the shot. And I used to think I could go around to high schools and shoot up girls every 3 months, and I would prevent all teenage pregnancy. However, as we know, there are young people that aspire to be pregnant as a teenager because we haven't given them better options during their teenage years, better aspirations, better role models, better opportunities. And then there is the IUD. And so the IUD has made a comeback. In the old days, there was the horrific Dalkon Shield, which was not properly researched or treated and did many bad, evil things to women. But now there are two options, the copper T and then the Mirena IUD, which is a levonorgestrel delivering device. And the Mirena IUD lasts for 5 to 7 years, and the copper IUD is 10 to 12 years. And the Mirena IUD releases a little bit of hormone that decreases the heaviness of periods. So it's actually used as a treatment for heavy periods. And about 70% of people at a year will have no periods. And for a lot of women, it's like, yay! for other women, it's like, oh, I was thinking my monthly period was my pregnancy test. But it's so effective. It's almost as effective as tubal ligation. And there is no contraindication for IUDs in people who have never had children or for teenagers. Whereas in the past, and some uneducated or people who haven't kept up to date, the OB-GYNs still say, oh, you haven't had a child, you can't have an IUD. And that's wrong. So we want to make sure our young people know that the IUD is an option. And the IUD is great. You stick it in. You don't think about it for 5 to 7 years. That covers you through high school. That covers you through college. You just swap it out. If you go to grad school, med school, law school, B schools, do it again. And then it's also reversible. So I have young people that are like, well, what if I want to get pregnant in a year or two? We'll take it out then. But at least for 2 years, you don't have to think about it.
And Lupe Rodriguez from Planned Parenthood, what are the laws both in California and how does that compare to other states with underage access to birth control?
In California, we're lucky that we have very great laws around access for teens. We have a law that allows young people to receive care for birth control, and not only that, for a lot of other services, for abortion care, for mental health care, allows them to seek that service and receive it without parental notification or parental consent. And that's huge because a lot of young people, you know, can't talk to their parents about these issues. And while we encourage that they do, we recognize that and feel that these laws are really important for them to have access. I think, though, you know, despite the fact that we have really great laws in California, what we've seen at Planned Parenthood and, you know, in the policy work that we're doing is that there's still barriers to access to care. Young people still have to make it to the clinic or to see their physician or their nurse practitioner to get the care that they need. They still have to, you know, find time. They still have to find money. Well, in California, actually, young women can apply for a program called Family Pact, which provides them with free or low-cost contraceptive care and also other types of reproductive health care.
And tell us what PACT stands for. That's an acronym. Can you tell us what that
stands
for?
Yes. No, I don't remember. I don't know if my fellow panelists know what that means.
It stands for Planning Access Care and Treatment, and it covers up to 200% of the federal poverty level or anybody who needs confidential health care. So you just come in, fill out 8 questions, and then you walk out with an insurance card that will cover all types of birth control and STD treatments with or without parental knowledge.
Yes, exactly.
One of the things you're talking about is really confidential services. And confidential services was really very helpful for teenagers in mental health services. It allows some confidentiality so teens can talk with their doc or their therapist and be protected. And around sexual issues, that's another area that's really hard to talk about. And, of course, therapists and docs are forced to disclose if the child's life is at risk in the psychological field. But it's really important for access to have places where kids can talk without their parents knowing that this is really going on.
And Jane Malden, you mentioned earlier that I think when we were talking before we started that how much are these laws about access making a difference in terms of the pregnancy rate in California versus other states that may have more restrictive laws around access for birth control to underage? I know you mentioned Texas, but I don't know what their laws are.
You know, I don't know the laws on that across the states. I did look at the abortion laws, and there are some paradoxical things that Texas refuses, and two states do not fund contraception for teens without parent consent. Publicly funded contraception requires parental consent. That's Texas and Utah. And Texas has one of the highest teen pregnancy rates in the country, which is 61. And Utah is lower than California's, and it's lower than many states. It's not as low as the New England states. It's around 30. So there's not a direct correlation between law and outcome. But laws do make a difference, but there are many other mediating factors. One area around the delivery of services I wanted to mention is school-based health centers, which are a really important venue for reproductive health care. And with the Affordable Care Act, and there are ways to try and connect, that school-based health centers do try to connect with insurance mechanisms, pulling down Medicaid funds or other kinds of public funds, to be able to provide at least reproductive health care without contraception. And in some schools, in some contexts, depending on the nature of the parental consent that's given, can also provide reproductive health, contraception. Mm-hmm.
And Lupe Rodriguez, California is, the Senate has just passed the assembly version of a law, and ideally it'll go on to, it'll be up to the governor to sign or veto, and that will permit RNs to write prescriptions for birth control. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly.
And well, what impact will that make in California?
It'll make a great impact. I think what Dr. Malden mentioned about, you know, the fact that the laws offer a lot of the sort of platform for people to have access, but they don't do everything. They don't, you know, there are still barriers to access to care. So what we've seen in California is that there aren't enough physicians, enough nurse practitioners to be able to provide some of the services that are needed, especially in rural areas and at community-based health centers. And so what this bill would do that just passed out of the Senate, AB 2348, it will allow registered nurses to be able to provide birth control, to dispense certain types of hormonal birth control that they can't do so now. And it'll be under a standardized procedure. It has been deemed safe, and so it will, you know, drastically increase access because it'll lower wait times. And I think for a lot of young people, again, you know, the barrier of getting to the health center and then having to wait there to get the care that they need it sometimes is insurmountable because they, you know, have to do it after school or, you know, at lunch before school. So, again, things like that are really important to think about. And this will allow for shorter wait times, the ability for people to be able to walk in to health centers and clinics, be able to get that care. It'll just make it a lot easier for people, for young people especially, to be able to get contraceptive care in California.
Dr. Sophia Yen, this kind of change can erupt into turf battles between MDs and nurses. Is this any issue for you? Is this something you, I don't mean to put you personally on the spot, but are physicians in general in support of this, or is there any risk to teens that they're that they could have some side effect from hormonal treatment that might be missed? Is there any downside?
So I think physicians that are interested in preventing unplanned, unwanted pregnancies will definitely support this measure. I don't think there's a turf battle. I think the only concern is if there is a family history of some clotting disorder that the young person doesn't know about per se, but that could happen in my office too if they showed up. So it doesn't really matter MD versus RN. And I think that nurses have gone through a huge amount of training. They run our ICUs. They're in the ER. They're everywhere we are. They dispense our medications, that they are perfectly capable of handing out birth control. And I know in other countries, the pharmacists do it as well, and they've gone through great training as well. So there will be a couple, you know, checks and balances in the way. And I think freer access to birth control will make a better world.
Okay. So I'd like to also speak for or address for a moment this issue of emergency, what's known as emergency contraception. And this is actually, Dr. Yen, why don't you go ahead and explain. It can be used, there's up to 5 days, but it's all dependent on a girl or a woman's menstrual cycle and when she's ovulating, right? So it's the sooner the better. But explain to us a little bit about emergency contraception, how it works, and what the politics are around that.
So the politics of emergency contraception, back in 2006, an FDA nonpartisan panel comprised of physicians and people of all parties and scientists came together and voted to send emergency contraception over the counter 23 to 4, no age restriction whatsoever. Never in our country's history has the FDA commissioner overridden the FDA nonpartisan medical panel for any medication in the entire history of this country. And the FDA commissioner appointed by Bush vetoed it. So then in 2009, I believe the Center for Reproductive Rights sued and said there is no medical or scientific basis for this. It's never been done in our country's history. The medical board advised that you send it over the counter because it's safe and young people need to access it. People need to access it. People know how to access it. It doesn't have any bad, evil side effects. And so they sued the United States government and they won a temporary injunction or something by a judge in New York, and an immediately went over the counter for 18-year-olds and then 17-year-olds. It went over the counter for 17-year-olds. So now 2011, the Center for Reproductive Rights says it's been too, and they have to review the case and say why they blocked it from going over the counter for those 16 and under. And it's 2011, and the Center for Reproductive Rights said, again, how come nothing's happened? You know, I know you're busy with other things, but you do have a head of the FDA. So the FDA revisited again, the medical panel voted again, send it over the counter. This time the commissioner voted, send it over the counter. However, this time the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, said, oh no, God forbid that 12-year-olds get access to this medication. And President Obama had the opportunity to say, when I came into office, I issued a statement saying that my administration would be based on science and not politics. However, he invoked his two young daughters and said, oh goodness, what if my two young daughters went into the pharmacy and got a pack of emergency contraception? And I counter back and invoke my two daughters. And I say, well, I'm going to educate my two daughters that if they go into a pharmacy, they could buy a bottle of ibuprofen, down it, and they could kill themselves. You go and buy a pack of emergency contraception and you down it, nothing happens. And so God forbid that your child would need it at age 12 because something horrific has happened to them and they need it. But if you withhold it from that young person, what happens? An unplanned, unwanted pregnancy. And a result of pregnancy is going to be far worse on that young person than the access to medication to prevent it. And so that is the politics. The science for emergency contraception that I hope everyone here knows, but at least I want to do the plug, is you have at least 5 days. So it used, on the package, it still says 72 days. And on some of the...
72 hours.
Sorry. Okay. Sorry. 5 days on the package, 72 hours, which would be 3 days. But you actually have 5 days per the WHO per 2006 research. And on the old packages, it was Plan B, or and you take one pill now, one in 12 hours, no longer. Now it's just one pill as soon as possible, as soon as something bad, evil happens. And the research has actually shown to allay the fears of our very conservative friends that once the egg and sperm hooks up, this medicine does nothing. A lot of physicians are still misinformed out there that this somehow has some mechanism to block implantation, but all the research existing pretty much shows that there is no efficacy after fertilization, and in fact, the evidence out there is showing to the contrary and probably explains why it fails most of the time. And so there's been papers out in 2006 and again in 2012, and there will be no more research looking at the mechanism of emergency contraception because they haven't found anything to support this blocking of implantation. And so we can allay our conservative friends that once the egg and sperm hooks up, it doesn't work. And the main mechanism is blocking the egg from coming out. So I say, if the condom pops at 3 a.m., I want the medicine in that young woman's mouth at 3:10. No cuddling, snuggling, huddling, waiting till the morning after, because you heard it was the morning after, or waiting till 5 days after. But if, God forbid, a friend comes to you at day three and says, oh, my God, I was raped last, you know, 2 days ago, and I could only come and tell you this now, then say, here, take this medicine. If she's already pregnant, it will do nothing. And if she hasn't ovulated yet, it will at least block the egg, and then she won't get pregnant.
I think one of the interesting things you see about the emergence of this medicine, really, is the psychological states of girls have really, there's early studies showing how positively they've responded to this medicine. And I have girls come in my office, they know about it, they're active, they ask about it. It gives them a lot more option for choice, which is what you're talking about, Loopy. I think that's so important to really be aware of. But I think knowing that, the girls know more about this than we do, and really what's out there and available. And I think it's very important that the population be informed about it too. And it really offers a great deal of option for young people and women. You know, really is a big maneuver in terms of building up choice for women.
But this is somewhat in conflict to what you said earlier, mm-hmm. which I also wanted to explore a little bit, and it dovetails off a question from the audience as well, is you're saying that girls are aware of this, but you also talked about girls' lack of understanding of their bodies. And their sexual desire.
Yeah.
And I was trying to understand how better understanding of their own desire would help them to prevent unplanned pregnancy.
Because I think thinking about awareness of a girl who's engaged in sexual activity, awareness of her own desire, herself really as the primary actor, or an equal actor in the sexual relationship is very important. Because what the studies really show and what I've seen with girls is they're very passive early on, particularly younger adolescent girls. This isn't all girls, and I have to say there's some girls out there who know more about their sexuality and could tell me quite a bit. So I think that's important. But to talk about the general group who is passive and they really talk about, they don't know about their bodies, they let sex happen to their bodies, so they see it in a very passive way. And you can imagine, Lisa, if you're much more the active person, if you know about your body, if you've masturbated several times, you have a good sense of your body's response, you know what you want in this interaction with this other person. That's really key. And how does this impact on pregnancy? It impacts on a lot of things, not only pregnancy. It gives you more confidence, makes you more the actor. You can think about what is your desire. Do you want to become pregnant? Some adolescent girls do, I think. So considering that, that's an important thing. Or do you not want to become pregnant? But many, many, and the rates are disturbingly high, 80, 90% of girls really will push that desire off onto their partner, whether boy or girl. You know, and I think that's important to really keep that in mind. That's, and it's hard when you think about the girls learning all about the morning after pills and everything else and knowing all of this, that they would be so passive in this area. But there's a lot of reasons for that. I think the view of American girls who are sexual as sluts really discourages knowing this part of your life and your body. You know, so there's a whole range of factors that play into it. The lack of discussion about masturbation for girls, really important factor. It's a good question, Lisa. Really good.
Okay. So I'd like to just, for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today's discussion focuses on the issues of teen pregnancy and young motherhood. We're here with Jane Malden, Associate Professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy, UC Berkeley, Lynn Ponton, Professor of Clinical Psychiatry at UCSF, Lupe Rodriguez, Director of Public Affairs for Planned Parenthood, Marmonte, and Dr. Sophia Yen, Clinical Assistant Professor at Lucile Packard Children's Hospital, Stanford School of Medicine. I'm Lisa Alaferis, Health Editor for KQED News in San Francisco. So, Jane Malden, I'd like to come back to you and talk about some of the issues around teen parenting and how we can better support teenagers who make a choice to become parents. And you did some research in the past around California programs that supported teen parents. What kinds of things, how can we counter this idea that teen parenthood is a disaster and an end to their lives?
Yeah, that's a very important question. And I just want to highlight that while some do choose parenthood, many, many get into parenthood by some accidental or even undesired way. So once one has a baby, the issue that most adults worry about is how is this young woman going to finish her education? That is the paramount question for observers, usually, and it's also the paramount question for public policy, and has been, it's a paramount question, it has been for a very long time. But we used to sort of try and segregate teen girls who were pregnant and send them off, if they got high school education at all, to some sort of special other kind of program. Now, there are there are still programs especially for teen parents, but they're not stigmatized in that way. They are instead constructed as much more supportive high school environments, ideally, this is to say, where they would include information around how to be an effective parent and make it easier for the teens to be physically close to their babies and to continue their education. So one of the strategies is simply to make high school and parenthood more compatible. Another is within the welfare program, the CalLearn program, offered case management through community-based social service and health organizations To support teens in all aspects of parenting and also in their own lives, in their own health, in their own mental health. And a very important one is in contraception, to prevent a subsequent birth. But then in addition had incentives to encourage teens to attend school and to graduate and either get a GED or attend high school. And so they would actually receive financial incentives to get grades, good grades, and to get a high school diploma. That was suspended. The state stopped funding it in the last fiscal year, and it appears to be slated for elimination. It's not really clear. It comes in and goes out. Last year, at least in Los Angeles, First Five picked up some of the funding. Mm-hmm. So in many areas, I think the program continued through other means. But so supporting them in education and in home visiting is another important area. You've got to be looking at the health care of the baby and the mother. So the family nurse practitioner programs that bring nurses into the homes is very important. Once you step into this area and start talking about education and healthcare, really what you bump up against is the overall deficits and lacks of access and opportunities for teenagers, lower-income teenagers, and teenagers of color, especially in this state and in this country. So it's really difficult to really advocate for comprehensive programming for teen parents. One wants to, but in the absence of sufficient supports towards high school completion and college education for lower income teens in general, that's the bigger picture.
Lupe Rodriguez, from Planned Parenthood, you mentioned that there are also big differences in teen parenting rates among different ethnic groups. Is that correct?
Yes, there are. It's seen across the country, in California as well. I want to add something first about what Dr. Malden said about programs and supports. In California, we've also seen very good results with a peer support program. It's actually Planned Parenthood. Marmonte has a program that's been replicated now throughout the country called Teen Success, which works with young women who are pregnant or parenting to help them maintain their family size. These are all young women who have unintended, unplanned pregnancies. And to graduate from high school and to go on to college. And so it allows them sort of the space to be supported by peers, and they meet every week. So it's a really, I think programs like that have a really high success rate, where a lot of young women who are pregnant or parenting have a two-thirds of them will not finish high school or get a GED. The rate for young women who have support systems is 80%. So 80% will finish high school and move on with their lives. So I think that's really important about sort of speaking to supportive programs. And so back to the question of the differences between ethnic people from different ethnic backgrounds on this issue, I think a lot of it has to do with, again, what Dr. Malden said about access to resources and access to support systems. I think what we also see in a lot of, the young women, Latina women, for example, have the highest rates of unintended and teen pregnancies. And I think a lot of it is because of the fact that there are, a poorer educational opportunities. It also, happens that Latino community often has the highest rates of being uninsured, also have the highest rates of, lower socioeconomic status, the inability to make ends meet, so to speak. So I think that's a huge factor that plays in part to this. And I think there's a myth that a lot of it is cultural. But there have been studies that show that Latino parents and parents of color, want their children to succeed just as other parents do. They want their children to go to school. They want their children, in fact, to have access to comprehensive sexuality education in schools. They want to be involved. And I think sort of recognizing that and not perpetuating that myth and stereotype is really important about to be able to advance and progress in ensuring that all young people from any ethnic background have the same opportunities and the same ability to make the best choices for themselves in their lives.
Dr. Yen, is that what you see in your practice as well?
I see In my practice, because we are a family pack provider, anybody can come and get services. So I think being uninsured is not an issue in California up to 200% of the federal poverty level because you have family pack. But maybe people aren't aware of family pack. Maybe the nearest family pack provider is miles away because mainly it's Planned Parenthood, and Planned Parenthood in some places have the abortion chop shop stigma, although they are 97% preventative services. And so we are lucky when we're near an academic center, but there are places like Merced and Modesto that don't have as many providers out there, and if somebody sees you going to that clinic, they know that you're doing something naughty. I think also that a lot of people are in denial because we've spent $1 billion on abstinence only of our tax dollars and not a single dollar towards comprehensive sex ed. And what they've shown is that people who are taught abstinence only cannot carry a condom in their wallet, right? They cannot be prepared because they will be a slut. They cannot be prepared because they were taught that they have to abstain. But their hormones are driving them. Media is driving them. And so to be prepared is a bad thing. So what I see is that parents are in denial that, no, my kid can't be sexually active, and that people should wake up and realize that teenagers are having sex and should allow young people to be educated about birth control and should allow young people to get birth control and have that private time with the doctor where we can get them birth control.
Well, Lynn Ponton, go ahead.
Yeah, one point I'd like to make about the teen parents and particularly teen moms is they have higher rates of depression than adult moms, and they really need services, psychological services, to be made available too. And if you treat the depression, it affects their ability to get the education, which you've mentioned, and also access to support systems. So I think being aware of that and treating the psychological aspects of the situation is really important. And so that's a part that is done at UC too and at other facilities that really provide care for this group.
I want to add one more thing about cultural variation, and I want it to intersect with age, because there is a huge difference between a 15-year-old having a baby and a 19-year-old having a baby. There are different ethnic groups, different cultural groups have all sorts of different cultural norms about what makes a good family, and in certain groups, earlier childbearing is the best thing. And there are tons of really good arguments for earlier rather than later fertility as a life strategy. But no group that I know of now in the United States would say 15 is the time to begin. But they might say 19, well, you know, that'll work. 20, well, that'll work too. And others would say, no, you got to get your MBA before you can start. But some of the strategies that we're talking about need to be tailored to acknowledge that we're not trying to eliminate all childbearing before you get the MBA. We simply need to focus on having young people who are in a position to really be able to take care of that child and maybe combine it with college education. Many of us would say that's not ideal, but many would also say that it's not ideal to wait long past your early 20s to start a family. That there are many groups that would say that's not a good idea. And so one has to balance these things and create policies that acknowledge a variety of different life strategies and life goals.
Well, we have a great question from the audience here, and along the lines of the media and the way sexuality is portrayed in media, but specifically this panel, the audience member writes, this panel is titled 16 and Pregnant, aptly named after the popular MTV show. How do you think this exposure to teen pregnancy has affected teen sexual activity and perception? Lynn Ponton, do you hear anyone
well,
coming
to
the clinic?
Well, they actually, you know, there was a movie called Juno, the movie about the pregnant teenage girl, and they now call it the Juno effect. Tried to make pregnancy look very popular. She did a good job with it, and it worked out well in the long run. So there are a lot of popular media descriptions, really, of young pregnant teens, and they make it look like a lot of fun. And it is, I think, fun for some kids.
But ultimately, in that movie, I hate to give it away, but she gave the baby, she gave up the baby for adoption.
She did do that, and she stayed best friends with the partner and the whole story, yes, Lisa. But I think to be aware of that is important, that the media does spin it. Juno was the best of the movies out there, one of the better ones to really look at in terms of that. Many do not really portray it that way. And to go back to adolescent girls' sexuality in the media is not portrayed in a positive way for the most part in America. Girls are seen as objects. You know, this gets back to not being the actor, the owner of their own bodies. And it really takes away their control. And their sexuality is often viewed from a male perspective, which is really, makes it difficult to deal with the media around this issue. Now, I do think the media provides excellent education because our kids are online in that age group. There's a Sex Etc., a website that's excellent out of New Jersey. So the media has some positive aspects and some negative aspects, but we need to educate our kids, about that balance.
Can I just chime in? I happen to do research on the medical accuracy of reproductive health websites, and we Googled birth control, STDs, whatever a teenager might want to do, and we took the top 35 websites that came up, and I audited them for accuracy with respect to IUD, to pap smears, to emergency contraception timing, window, et cetera. And most of them got the answers wrong. So it's important that you go to a good website. And even WebMD got their answers wrong. So what you want to go is to an adolescent medicine tailored website. I like the one out of Boston Children's Hospital, Young Women's Health, et cetera, is a great one. Scarlet Teen is a great one. Planned Parenthood has a great one. Those were the top three scores. And Ask Alice out of Columbia in our research study. And you can also Google my research study, 10 top myths on the web or something about reproductive health. So I just want people to be aware that the TV has one image and the web has another image, but you have to know who your sources are, and even your sources, which are Mayo Clinic, got it wrong too. It depends who their expert is. If they're not calling an adolescent medicine expert, they may not be in tune with the things that I would put in there for a teenager. I would put in that, it's over-the-counter for 17 and above, men and women, and that if you're under that age, you need a prescription. But in the state of California, there are some pharmacists that are licensed to just give it over-the-counter, so that's great. But you have to go to the website, 188, not too late, or something like that, and find that pharmacist, and you've got to call ahead and make sure that they have it. But the other thing I want to put out there is that men have an opportunity, young men, in participating in emergency contraception. And my mantra is wherever there's a heterosexual male that doesn't want to impregnate, and wherever there's a female, regardless of her orientation, because God forbid she gets raped, there should be a pack of Plan B. Because on your way to the emergency room post-rape, I want you to pop that medicine into your mouth if you're a young woman. And any man, if you see a condom pop, if you don't know about emergency contraception, you'll be like, oh, my God, I'll stand by her side. I'll support her decision, but there's nothing I can do, right? Wrong. If you have the pack of emergency contraception, you'll be like, excuse me, the condom popped. Here's the emergency contraception. Let's prevent pregnancy. But otherwise, the man may never tell the woman that the condom popped. And so I tell young women, watch that condom go in, watch that condom go out, but everybody have a pack of emergency contraception.
Can I add something? This is Lupe Rodriguez about that issue that I think it's really important to educate the male partners. I think at Planned Parenthood we do a lot of work around dispelling myths. That's really important, and working with male partners to be able to talk to them and have them understand these things just as well as women, and really make it a part. Because I think what we see anecdotally is that a lot of young women feel it's their responsibility to prevent pregnancy all the time. It's sort of borne on their shoulders, and I think we're trying to change that in a lot of the educational programs that we have at Planned Parenthood. And additionally, I think parents play a great role because same thing, getting them comfortable with talking to their kids, getting them the right information. I think it sort of speaks to some of the things that we were talking about culturally. If parents don't themselves know, a lot of the new information, they don't understand new technologies, they don't understand the laws maybe even around access to services or access to abortion care or things like that, then, you see issues of misinformation happening there as well. So I think it's really important to talk about that parent education is really important as well.
The question I was trying to get to weave in here was from the audience, speaking about what are effective ways professionals are educating teen boys on pregnancy, and is that an area that needs to be strengthened? Yes.
Add again that yes. It's absolutely very important. And again, one of the programs that we have at Planned Parenthood is a male partner program to get them involved in talking about these issues. And again, you know, that they also have, if they would like to prevent pregnancy, if they're having sex with their girlfriends, that they have a space to talk about those issues. And it's not just on their girlfriend's shoulders to figure that out. And it's called the Male Involvement Program, actually. And it works on a lot of other issues about, you know, education, just like the Teen Success Program I spoke about, works with them to, you know, help them with educational opportunities and other opportunities to help them progress and advance and, you know, become productive citizens.
I think also that boys need to be educated about their own sexuality and their own sexual desire. There's been a lot of pressure put on boys to really know everything about the sexual act, to be the sexperts, really, in the combo. And boys are not really that way. When you look at their basic knowledge, they don't have that, and they really need to be developed in that area. So the type of program you're talking about is really helpful. A lot of the comprehensive sexual education programs in the school are emphasizing involvement of the boys, too, and really encouraging them to be active in this. So that's very important, Lisa.
Lynn Ponton, I also wanted to ask you, without getting into the politics around abortion, we've talked a lot about there's a great many more teen pregnancies than there are teen parents. Many teens elect to terminate their pregnancies. And you've done research around what happens to teens who choose to abort and how they fare psychologically. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think I have done some research in that area. And I think some of the most important work was done by a group led by Nancy Adler here, really over about 30 years of work looking at teen abortions and teenagers who choose to have an abortion and what's involved with that. And some of the most interesting information is how they look at the time they make that choice, then how they look 5 years later, how they look 10 years later, and how compared with groups who choose to have the baby and how they look 5 and 10 years later. And what it really shows is that the girls who choose to have an abortion do not fare worse than the girls who choose to have the baby or give the baby up for adoption. In many cases, the girls who choose to have the abortion really fare better. And I think this answers some of the group who says this is terrible for adolescent girls who make this choice. They'll really regret it years later. And you really look
meaning they will regret
their decision to have an abortion. Exactly.
Okay.
Lisa. So I think it's important to know that this can be a positive decision and choice in a woman's life. But I think, as you were saying, Lupe, it's so important that girls make that choice with support and they have information and help really with that decision.
Okay. We have a question from the audience. Someone who sees in their work young women who become pregnant not because it was planned or unplanned, but it was consciously not prevented. Most knew about birth control, but they say, I don't really have any friends, only my boyfriend. Is there a relationship between, Sophia Yen, is there a relationship between positive peer support and teen pregnancy prevention? I mean, what do people tell you in their, your practice? Is this something you come across?
I do think that if you have too many pregnant people around you, then you want to join the team, perhaps, happens in some groups. If all your friends are pregnant and they're preparing for the baby and they're having baby showers, then you too may want to have a baby shower next. If you see the consequence afterwards of the baby and you're hanging out with that friend with the baby screaming every 2 hours for the next 3 months, then maybe you'll be turned off that. But I think this is a question of relationship between the male and the female. And oftentimes, you know, we try to teach the young woman no glove, no love. You know, if the guy won't put on a condom, no sex. You can do everything outside of that, oral sex, mutual masturbation, bump and grind, all crazy kind of stuff, but you don't have to risk pregnancy. And so these young women don't have the confidence in themselves to say, if you don't honor me to respect my wishes, then I'm not going to have sex with you. If I don't have sex with you, then I'm going to lose that significant other. Or I've heard in some communities a young woman who graduated Wellesley and then went back to her community and said, well, your boyfriend has baby by these other girls. How come you don't? You're not woman enough, or, you know, whatever, and then she got pregnant. And this is a Wellesley-educated woman who I would hope would be a slight feminist, but obviously succumbed to peer pressure. So I think there's definitely self-confidence, peer pressure, negotiating with your significant other. And so that's why I do think the burden lies upon the woman. I tell every man, control your sperm. If the sperm leaves your body, then it's a woman's decision. She can make you a daddy, or she can terminate the pregnancy. It's her body, her choice. So control the sperm before it leaves you. And for the women, never assume that the condom is going to be intact, that the condom won't pop. It's better to be double protected. And by that, we mean a condom plus some hormonal contraception.
Jane Malden.
Can I add quickly that?
Okay, go ahead.
That I also think that speaks to what I was saying earlier about educational opportunities and opportunities generally that people feel they have. I think in a lot of the sort of research that's come from the teen success groups and the work that we do with teens at Planned Parenthood, we know that young women feel like sometimes becoming pregnant is their only sort of way out of their home with their families, the only way to advance their lives, to kind of enter into adulthood. And so I think that that's a big part of it as well, that if they feel like they don't have opportunities outside of becoming pregnant, if they don't feel like they're loved outside of that, or again, that their partner is their only friend, that becomes a part of their mentality and not being able to advance outside of that or see that there's possibilities to do other things with their lives.
Jane Malden, I see you writing something down again. Did you want to? did you have something to add to that, or shall?
Well, I was reflecting on the way that babies are a source of love and a source of self-esteem, and that in a society that gives far too little access to other sources of sort of accomplishment for teens, babies can be a very important sense of efficacy, accomplishment, and so adulthood, not just in the sort of In a broader sense of, like, I can do something here. I'm a real person. And we don't have enough other ways that a whole group, tons and tons of teens who go to bad schools either don't graduate or graduate and then don't know where to go next, start community college and then can't get the courses they need and drop out. I mean, the number of undereducated young people in this country is phenomenal, and that has to be tied to higher rates of teen childbearing than in other countries.
Mm-hmm. Also, this is an election year, a presidential election year. We have a question from the audience, which was in my mind too, is how much does the tide turn with a possible change of administration from Democrat to Republican?
So I'm a huge reproductive rights advocate. I've come out several times against parental notification. I've started a campaign called the Silver Ribbon Campaign, where you wear a silver ribbon if you trust women to make their own personal health decisions. And when people ask you, is that a pink ribbon you're wearing? And you're like, no, it's a silver ribbon. And did you know the crazy stuff that's going down in Congress, such as they voted an act called Let the Women Die Act. If a pregnant woman shows up in the ER and if she's going to die unless you terminate her pregnancy, the doctor can say, let her die. And never in our country's history, I thought we respected the life of the woman. But as we know, the Republican platform makes no exception for abortion in case of life, in case the life of the woman, or rape, or incest. So I think it's huge, the difference between the parties. It's clear that if a woman has some horrific pregnancy and she needs to terminate it, we've seen several cases where a woman shows up in the ER, and if it's a Catholic hospital, they say, we cannot do anything for her until she's in sepsis, until there is bacteria running through her blood amok, and she's bleeding out and her blood pressure is dropping. Only then can we act. And that's just inhumane, treating women as second-class citizens.
And I'll add that in 2011, there was an unprecedented record of new restrictions against reproductive health access for women across the country in very many different states, many led by anti-choice legislators. So I think that that's really important to think about, that the election is an opportunity to change a lot of what's happening at the state level, at the federal level. Again, in 2011, there was the unprecedented move to stop funding for Planned Parenthood and other providers of reproductive health care services across the country by cutting the Title X family planning program. And so I think a lot of these things have been happening because there are, in fact, a lot of anti-choice legislators in Congress and at the state level. And so so I think that the election allows an opportunity for folks who believe that reproductive health services and women's health and women's lives are important to act and to really look at who they're electing.
I think it's not only the rulings around choice that we have to look at, but commentary about sexual education for children and adolescents in general. And I think one of the things that Obama said early is we need to begin sexual education in our country in kindergarten. You know, people laughed then, but I think this, again, is another chance to really look at that. I would kind of dissuade us from labeling Democrats one view and Republicans another view and lining them up that way, because I think candidates really need to be looked at in terms of how they voted and their views on these particular issues. And it's a lot of work for us as the voter to really do that, I think. But it's so important, and I think it's very important to vote, because a really interesting book named Backlash has really talked about how there's movement in our country. One of the biggest problems isn't how many Democrats or Republicans there are, but the large number of people that don't vote, don't read about these issues, don't come to these discussions and really talk about these things. And that's a very large part of the population. But I think it is time to become informed about these issues. So we should listen to our candidates.
Okay. We're very close to running out of time here, but I will, Jane Malden, one thing that it does, the issue of parental notification for abortion makes, I mean, some parents are very somewhat understandably concerned about the possibility of their child having an abortion without their knowing about it. What is the counter argument to that fear that parents might have? Why should these laws be in place?
Why should teens be able to have access to abortion without parental notification? Well, the simple model would be if a teen, almost all teens do talk to their parents. Even if they don't have to, they do talk to their parents. They tell their parents that they're pregnant and they talk to their parents about what's going to happen. And if the abortion is not with the parents' full approval, it is almost always with the knowledge, or at least tacit knowledge, but often explicit knowledge. So that's it's a very small group for whom this is a relevant question, right? And you do have to wonder in a family if a teen wants an abortion and doesn't want to talk to her parents about it, what are the reasons for that? And there are really scary reasons that might be behind that, including sexual assault, incest. You know, there are really toxic situations, probably rare, but certainly there. And others of family violence, child abuse. So the idea that there's a loving, intact whole sort of family with where the parents are willing and able to support the child and the child will go ahead and have an abortion without talking to the parent is, of course, the one that we want to kind of prevent. We want to involve those good parents. But in fact, the data suggests that those good parents, effective parents, communicating parents, are generally involved anyway. And I turn to the MDs people in Planned Parenthood who probably know more than I about this.
So I think you've really said it, that it's a high-risk group that this applies to. And they're sad situations when they come into our office. And they come to the hospital, to the office, and they want abortions, and they have not told their parents. And they are very tragic, and there are good reasons. And you've said that.
I'm afraid we're out of time for this evening. I really want to thank our panelists, Dr. Sophia Yen, clinical assistant professor at Lucile Packard Children's Hospital, Stanford School of Medicine, Jane Malden, associate professor at Goldman School of Public Policy, UC Berkeley, Lynn Ponton, professor of clinical psychiatry at UCSF, and Lupe Rodriguez, director of public affairs for Planned Parenthood Marmonte. Thank you to the California Wellness Foundation for underwriting this program. Thanks to our audience here and on the radio. I'm Lisa Alaferis, health editor at KQED. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.